This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Poet Laureate of the United States, Ted Kooser, and here he is with an opening poem.
Morning glories. We share so much. When I write lattice, I count on you seeing the flimsy slats tacked into squares and painted white, like a French door propped in a garden with the blue condensed from many skies pressed up against the panes. I count on you knowing that remarkable blue, shaped into the fluted, amplifying horns of Edison cylinder record players. What? Come on, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I didn't need to describe them like that, but I like to hover a little over my words, dabbling the end of my finger in the white throats of those. You fill it in. I could go on, but all I really needed to do was to give you the name and the title. I knew you'd put in the rest, maybe the smell of a straw hat hot from the sun. That's just a suggestion. You know exactly what else goes into a picture like this to make it seem as if you saw it first, how a person can lean on the warm hoe handle of a poem, dreaming, making a little more out of the world than was there just a moment before. I'm just the guy who gets it started.
That's the voice of Ted Kooser, and he is this year's winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Today we're reading from a book that isn't exclusively Ted's poems. So tell us what this book is.
This is a book called The Poetry Home Repair Manual. I wrote it. It's really more of a philosophy of writing than a writing manual. I have a good deal of information in it about technique and craft and so on, but it's more about me suggesting that people think about the audience for poetry and steer their work toward an imaginary reader and so on.
And how long did this book come together? How long did it take in the making?
Assembling it probably took around a year. What I had done was I teach tutorially at the University of Nebraska. I have 12 students. I give them each an hour piece a week privately.
Wow.
And then when I want to talk to all of them at once, I would send them an email, and I began doing this sort of like an email lecture about a poem. I'd find a poem, and then I'd type it into the email, and then I'd talk about it. And so I saved these emails, and they all sort of came together in this book. I mean, there's a lot of other writing in it as well, but that was the basis of it.
Well, we're going to taste a little from each chapter. There are 12 chapters, and we may not hit all of them, but we're going to give you the meat from several of them. And for just starters, let us read a poem. It's on page 3, I think. It's called The Poet.
Once you were young along a river, tree to tree, with sleek black wings and red shoulders. You sang for yourself, but all of them listened to you. Now you're an old blue heron with yellow eyes and a gray neck tough as a snake. You open your book on its spine, a split fish, and pick over the difficult ribs, turning your better eye down to the work of eating your words as you go.
That is by Ted Kooser. Not all the poems you'll hear today are by Ted, but they are poems he's chosen because they're significant for one reason or another. And what is this poem about? It's called Poetry Reading, right?
Yes, It's about the difference between being a poet and writing poems, and that when you're young, often you're much more involved and absorbed by being a poet and wearing the beret and the black turtleneck and being sexy and interesting. And then when you get older, you're more interested in the poems you've written and so on. So it's a transitional poem.
But in this chapter, it's very important because it lays the groundwork for the book, and it invites everyone to the party in a way. It says, you are entitled.
Yes,
you're allowed to try your hand.
That's right. I see nothing wrong with a world in which everybody is writing poems. They may not be publishable poems, but what better way of using your time, you know?
And you said it keeps one more scoundrel off the streets.
That's right, yeah.
I think that's better. Instead of scoundrel, poet.
Yeah.
Good trade-off. Yeah. So that is how the poem begins, by saying, this is a world you can enter. Why not try your hand at it? And then we proceed with the nuts and bolts of it, which is about the Poetry Home Repair Manual. And we go into the specifics. For example, first impressions. I think that that's a title of a chapter, isn't it? First impressions?
Yes, it is.
And what does first impressions mean?
Well, it means the opening line, the title and the opening lines of a poem, how they affect a reader. You know, it's very much like meeting a stranger in life. You don't walk right up to them and begin shouting into their face. You know, you move with some grace toward them, you know, and that's the way I think poems should open, not necessarily all of them, but can open effectively, I guess.
That's a good point, mm-hmm. because I always tell students it's like walking into a room. Do you want to knock over a chair, you know, or kick someone in the shins?
Yeah, that's very good, yeah.
Yeah, so you do have some samples there we'd love to hear, and one of them I think is called The Bell Rope.
The Bell Rope.
That's on page 28. That's a very nice entry.
Yes, this is a poem of Robert Morgan's, and it moves very smoothly from conversation towards something else. Bell Rope. The line through the hole in the dank vestibule ceiling ended in a powerful knot worn slick, swinging in the breeze from those passing. Half an hour before service, Uncle Alan pulled the call to worship, hauling down the rope like the starting cord of a motor. And the tower answered and answered, fading as the clapper lolled aside. I watched him before Sunday school heave on the line as on a well rope, and the wheel creaked up there as heavy buckets emptied out their startle and spread a cold splash to farthest coves and hollows, then sucked the rope back into the loft, leaving just the knot within reach, trembling with its high connections.
What was the point that you made about that poem?
Well, it's just that you are into the poem before you even notice that you're on the way.
Mm.
You know, it is that conversational and that smooth an entry into the poem. And I was trying to talk about that. This is the way that you ease a person into the sort of the pew of the poem in the church of the poem.
And it also moves from the concrete to the abstract in that poem very skillfully.
Yes, very skillfully. Bob Morgan is a tremendous poet. Yeah.
And one thing I really loved about this book is that I met poets I had never met before. You have introduced me to poets, I think, many of whom were not well-published, perhaps even.
Mm-hmm.
But you've come along in your life, and you've found a poem, and you have really made a very important indentation in their lives.
Well, thank you. I have copied out poems that I've seen for years and years into, you know, file folders and so on, and it was just a matter of going through and finding them again. And it is true that some of these poets are very little known. They should be better known, but, you know, and maybe this will help a little
bit. Well, as Poet Laureate, I think you can accept that compliment, that of all the Poet Laureates, you have really opened very large doors for people and for us. You know,
well, thank you,
we want
Grace.
To thank you for that. And along that line, we have another poem that you point out, which I thought was very interesting, by Joseph Stroud. And here you say there's very inventive ways of using a first line
mm-hmm.
of a poem. Sometimes it can be incorporated into the body of the poem. So let's hear that one.
Yes, this one is particularly interesting because the title of the poem is actually the last line of the poem moved forward, because it follows in sequence from the narrative, and you can pick it out from the example. The title is, "And I Raised My Hand in Return." Every morning for 2 weeks on my walk into the village, I would see the young goat on the grassy slope above the stream. It belonged to the gypsies who lived in the plaza below the castle. One day on my walk back to the mill house, I saw the little goat hanging from a tree by its hind legs, and a gypsy was pulling the skin off with a pair of pliers, which he waved to me in greeting. And then, of course, the title is, "And I Raised My Hand in Return," as if perhaps he raised it inadvertently, you know, to wave back, you know.
But look at that poem. I think it's about 8 lines.
Yes.
How much is accomplished? We have a view of another culture.
That's
a whole
right.
culture is introduced in
yeah,
that.
Right.
And the matter-of-fact way of skinning an animal, which isn't something you see walking down the street in Washington.
With a pair of pliers.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we believe this is an American poet
mm-hmm.
raising his hand in return.
Oh, yeah.
So much is happening mm-hmm. psychologically.
Absolutely.
So that was a really nice. I don't know this poet.
Well, he lives in California. He's published, I believe, 2 or 3 volumes with Copper Canyon. I really admire his
work.
I'm
going to look him up.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
We're at the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri with Ted Kooser, who is author of Poetry Home Repair Manual. And we're going through it a little bit by little bit because it's the book. If you want to choose one book to teach your class, this is the one. It's from the University of Nebraska Press, and you can simply get it by going on the internet and getting their address. It is also, I think, on the shelf now. Is it on the shelf?
Oh, yeah.
In
bookstores? Yeah.
Okay. So we are talking about entry lines and good titles, and that is what the chapter First Impression is about. Then you go into the idea of there are really no rules.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 4.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, don't worry about the rules. Okay, what are the rules in poetry?
You know, I believe that a poem is the record of a discovery. The discovery can be made in life, it can be made in language, and so on. But the poem then records the discovery. And the only rule really worth establishing for yourself is, does it meet the standards that you want for the poem? And you have to decide that yourself. There are poems that are written that are very loose and free, and you can move words around in them without damaging the poem so much, and that is one person's standard of poetry. There are poets like me who can't do that, can't stand to have that kind of freedom, you know, that I don't want any word that can be moved around in my poem or any punctuation mark without diminishing the effect. That's my standard, but everybody can set their own standards, and I guess that's a rule about not having rules, in a way.
Good point. Yeah. Are you still learning how to write poetry?
Oh, yes, yeah, with every poem, sure.
What was the last thing you learned?
Oh, gosh, Grace, I can't remember.
But are you writing this year at all?
I'm not. I haven't been able to do much writing this year. I've been so busy.
I know. Accepting all those awards, it fills the day. Going up to get the Pulitzer,
another. It's the mail. It's the correspondence and the phone calls and that sort of thing. And also, you know, being out talking to a lot of people and so on. And I don't mind putting off writing for a couple of years, you know. I mean, it's something that I certainly miss, but this is a very important job, and I want to do it well. I want to especially do it well since I'm the first poet laureate from the middle of the country and or from the Great Plains, and you know, I want to prove to everybody that we guys can do it out there, you know.
And that brings up another theme of your book, and that is that to be a poet is to be of service. That
I
is
think
part
so.
Of That's the mandate.
I think that's absolutely true, yes.
It's not a bad thing to live for something bigger than yourself.
That's right.
You know, most of the poets I know are pretty high consciousness, and they don't make a lot of money, as you know, but there's something more important about being alive, and this book is about entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
In this book, you're saying every chapter, hey, this is the way this person does it. This is the way you might want to do it.
Yeah.
It's not exactly that Mount Olympus is too small.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah.
Ted Kooser, Grace Cavalieri, together again, and I'm glad. We're talking about Poetry Home Repair Manual. And we then move into, we say there are no rules, but there are things called form and syllabics and syllables. And you tackle that. So there are a few poems in there that are, I think, significant in what they reveal. Kim's poem, The Aquarium. Let's read that one.
Yes, this is Kim Adonisio, Aquarium. The fish are drifting calmly in their tank between the green reeds, lit by a white glow that passes for the sun. Blindly, the blank glass that holds them in displays their slow progress from end to end. Familiar rocks set into the gravel, murmuring rows of filters. A universe the flying fox and glass cats, Congo tetras, bristle-nosed plecostemus all take for granted. Yet the Pleiades, gold and red, persist in leaping occasionally, as if they can't quite let alone a possibility of wings, maybe, once they reach the air. They die on the rug. We find them there, eyes open in surprise. Now, that's a sonnet, but it doesn't sound like a sonnet, does it? It is so graceful and conversational that you don't feel the form.
Read the first line, and we'll hear the pentameter.
The fish are drifting calmly in their tank. Yeah, it's there.
So you can hear that. And you mentioned that in that chapter.
Yeah.
If you count that, the fish are drifting, what's the next word?
Calmly
in their tank.
Yeah.
And each line is well grounded in pentameter, but it's, you wouldn't trip over it.
Yeah, and she varies the pentameter, you know, between the green reeds, you know, that sort of thing, so that it feels conversational, you know. It is driven by the pentameter rhythm carried along, but it is opened. It has been opened.
Then I bet that you wrote that poem in your book, but I bet you never read it out loud, and I have to give you credit for the name of that fish.
When
you got there, when you got to that fish, I thought, if I was reading that cold, I wouldn't have.
Yeah, well, I probably screwed up the names of all the fish. Plecostemus.
I think you did.
Yeah.
I thought, I gave him a degree of difficulty.
I think she'll forgive me for that.
Right. Yeah. And I think she'd be grateful that somebody is on to her. Quite smooth.
She's a marvelous poet.
She's young.
Yeah.
She's got
She, too, is a California poet. Yeah.
Yeah. And there is another in that chapter, which is not always pentameter, the men who raised the dead. That's a good example you use for syllables, if you will read that to us and talk about that poem.
The men who raised the dead. If they had hair, it was gray. The backs of their hands, wormy currents of blue veins, old men the undertaker believed had already lost too much to the earth to be bothered by what they found, didn't find. Brought there that May afternoon, dogwood trees bloomed like white wreaths across Jocassee's valley. They took their time, sought the shade when they tired, let cigarettes and silence fill the minutes until the undertaker nodded at his watch. And they worked again, the only sound the rasp and shuck of shovels as they settled deeper in graves twice dug, sounding for the thud of struck wood not always found, sometimes something other, silk scarf or tie, buckle, button, nestled in some darker earth, enough to give a name to. One quit before they were done, lay down as if death were now too close to resist, and so another stepped in his grave, finished up, but not before they shut his eyes, laid him with all the others to be saved, if not from death, from water. That's Ron Rash.
What a wonderful poem. Where is he from?
He teaches in North Carolina and has published several books now. The reason I use this poem in here is it's written in syllabics, that is, every line is counted, both the accented and unaccented syllables. Every line is exactly 7 syllables long.
Read us the line.
If they had hair, it was gray. Or, the backs of their hands wormy. Consistently 7 all the way through.
And what is the value of that?
I think, I don't know, from my point of view, if I were writing in that, and I have written that way, it is a matter of a feeling. A sense of order, I think, that it's a little, perhaps a little obsessive, but it's the feeling that you're really creating something that has an order to it, a structure to it.
It doesn't sound obsessive.
No, not at all.
You see, that's the beauty.
Yeah.
I think some people do, you know, but don't, But that one is really moves, that really flows.
Yeah, the book that this came from is, the whole book is written in this form.
Every one?
Every one of them, yeah.
The same syllable count per line?
7 syllables, yeah.
So you feel, you know, somebody's in charge of it.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's really a matter of trust, isn't it? Yeah, that's one thing we really, if there's one thing we have to punctuate, it's the reader who can relax and know that someone is in charge.
Yeah, that's a good point,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm. And I think that you aspire to that yourself, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You don't want a bunch of readers without boundaries.
No.
Running around wild, not knowing what you're talking about.
Yeah.
This is Ted Kooser, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're together at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're talking about a new book that tells you what Ted notices in poems, I guess. And some of the poems you've noticed you are putting in a newspaper column.
Yes, I have a new newspaper column that is free to any newspaper that wants to use it coast to coast or away from here. It's can be found at www.americanlifeinpoetry.org. All you have to do is go on there and download it from that. Newspapers are asked to register so we can keep track of what the circulation is. At the time that you and I are doing the show, we have been up and running for 5 weeks. We have, I believe the last report was around 55 papers signed up. We have a combined circulation of 5.6 million readers.
And describe the column.
Well, it's a short poem that I think newspaper readers can understand. I introduce it with two or three sentences. Let's say something like, poets sometimes do this, or have you ever noticed this, that sort of thing. Then a short poem, and then the credits, really.
That's the beauty
it.
Of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not off-putting. You
yeah.
see this, and it's all in place. It's all intact.
Yeah.
It's one page, and it's something that you go right to. It's immediate.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of this book a lot. It has the same flavor.
Well, I suppose it would. I'm writing the columns. I have a couple of graduate assistants at the University of Nebraska who are helping me look for poems for it. But other than that, I'm doing the writing. So.
And that is a new idea. Who conceived of that?
Well, my wife is a newspaper editor in Lincoln, Nebraska. She's the editor of the daily paper there. And she and I have been talking about trying to get poetry back in papers for years and years. You know, it was in there for 200 years. And then in the last century, it sort of drifted away. And we're trying to get it back. And I was very fortunate that the Poetry Foundation in Chicago gave me some money to pay for the graduate assistants and get it started. And they also built the website that we're using.
But it was Kathleen's idea.
It was Kathleen's
idea.
Okay,
we have to make that clear.
It was her idea, yeah.
We're going to read another from this book, and I think I'm going to ask you to read a prose poem.
All right.
That is by Robert Bly. That's page 53. Just because I want the audience to know the whole panoply of the poems you choose.
Okay, looking at a dead wren in my hand. Forgive the hours spent listening to radios and the words of gratitude I did not say to teachers. I love your tiny rice-like legs that are bars of music played in an empty church and the feminine tail where no worms of empire have ever slept and the intense yellow chest that makes tears come. Your tail feathers open like a picket fence and your bill is brown with the sorrow of an old Jew whose daughter has married an athlete. The black spot on your head is your own mourning cap.
And what is that poem referring to?
I really think that it is a description of a dead wren in his hand.
I do, too.
It's very typical of Robert Bly's work. It flies off in all sorts of directions from that, but every direction is tethered back to the original purpose of the poem.
And what do you think a prose poem is?
Well, I think it is poetry that is almost as carefully controlled as poetry in form. The difference for me, the principal difference, is that it is not as intimidating to new readers of poetry as a poem in form. You know, so many readers were discouraged from poetry in the schools and so on by having to find the one meaning of the poem as if it were a riddle. And the prose poem sort of, you know, you're into it before you realize that you're reading poetry. You think it's just another paragraph, you know.
Hmm.
I mean, that's a very simplistic way of looking at it. But
one way. I asked Ray Whittemore, and he said it came from the French, and that's all we know.
Yeah, that's right.
I guess Valéry was the first
something.
Right. Yeah. But he said, I keep asking people for definitions, and that's a new one for me because I think you go from margin to margin, and it still needs the lyrical tension in the middle, though.
Oh, yeah, it does.
It's different from prose.
Yeah. And the prose poems that are strongly narrative don't feel quite right. They the more lyrical they are, that's the way I respond to them.
Well, people are getting away with murder with prose poems.
Yeah.
You know, they're just setting the typewriter from end to end, metaphorically.
Well, the nice thing about people getting away with murder in any kind of poetry is that the poetry is not likely to endure. You know, they are much more ephemeral, I think.
And it can't hurt anybody.
It cannot.
This is a murder that cannot hurt a soul.
It can't hurt a soul.
Yeah. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our guest is Ted Kooser, who is Poet Laureate of the United States. we're back now, and we're going to go through a book we're talking about called Poetry Home Repair Manual. And this is a book that talks about the nuts and bolts, the craft, but the spirit of poetry. And that's what Ted Kooser has brought to Washington, the spirit of the craft. And we've been talking about some of the ways of entering a poem, some of the ways of ending a poem. And in chapter 5, you have a wonderful title called Rhyming Ham Cubes and Prose Poems. Impossible to ignore a chapter headed like that. What are the ham cubes?
Well, you know, for years in grocery stores, when you bought ham cubes, they'd come in a little plastic tray with just some cellophane over the top or saran wrap or whatever you call it. And there was a lot of dead grocery store air in there. Now they've begun to do it with a kind of shrink wrap, so the wrapping actually fits the ham cubes. And I'm talking about form, saying that poems that are written in fixed forms ought to be as tightly wrapped in the form or as that, so you don't have any stale air in the poem, that the poem really ought to fit the form perfectly. And that's really the metaphor I'm working with. The book was reviewed by someone, I can't remember who, and who objected to that, saying it was a little coarse image to use with form, but I think it works pretty well myself.
Oh, I didn't know. I have missed the reviews. So do you have several of them for this book?
Oh, it's been reviewed a couple of times. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a review in the Wall Street Journal, which may be the one I'm thinking of, but I can't remember right now.
But mostly favorable?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If that's the only thing ever said against you, that your ham cubes are too tight, that's okay with me.
Yeah, that's right.
Ted Kooser.
Well, my position with reviews has always been, I try not to read reviews of my work. It's, you know, the painful ones really are painful, and the good ones are often kind of gassy and fulsome, you know, so you, full of praise that you think, oh, come on. You
but
know,
if you believe the good ones, you have to believe the bad ones. That's the worst part.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So let's not meddle with them. Let's not even meddle with them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. Then we have talk about rhyme. Now, rhyme is the biggest bugaboo in, I think, the fledgling poet's career, because I teach seminars with people who have never really written much. And there is the first thing they want to do is rhyme. And you put it in its place. You tell us when it works and when it doesn't work. So there is a sample of unobtrusive rhyme you talk about by Ed Weissmuller.
Mm-hmm.
And that poem is The Seahorse. So that would be a very good example to talk about rhyme that's hidden and doesn't offend anyone.
Yes.
That's number 7.
Yes, Seahorse. You might think it would leap the waves in a white fire of foam, racing, eyes mad with what might be delight, a runaway, or loosed from a god's team galloping in its vast pasture. But this one was the size of a brooch, thin and red gold and still. The children had sent for it from the Atlantic. It arrived by air in a pouch of seawater, containing all it needed to sustain life as it crossed the continent. Following instructions, we made it a small, nourishing ocean in which it anchored itself upright to a strand of seaweed, and staring, jewel-eyed at nothing, slowly faded white and died. But this is an example of a poem that has a lot of rhyme in it, but they're very neatly woven into the lines, into the middles of the lines, and we feel the effect of the rhyme, you know, at some sort of less-than-conscious level, I think. But it's very carefully put placed there. You know, there are all sorts of rhymes.
Why don't you point out a couple of those words?
Galloping in its vast pasture, or seawater containing all it needed to sustain life. Mm-hmm. Those, you know, half rhymes, slant rhymes, and so on throughout, you know.
Ed Weissmuller is a blind poet. Mm-hmm. A Milton scholar,
mm-hmm.
and he is at the Library of Congress every day doing research.
A marvelous man, yeah.
He is.
He was the first of the Yale Younger Poets, the very first one.
I know. And he is truly a servant to poetry. I was so happy to see that you made his friendship, mm-hmm. because that would mean a lot to him. And he's at every reading. He's at the poetry reading.
Oh, yeah.
This is a masterful poem, so I'm really glad you gave Ed notice. That means a lot. Not only are you teaching us things in this book, but you're really touching a lot of poets' lives. To be included is pretty
important.
Well,
thank you.
You know that, yeah. So there's an example of rhyme which is embedded in the poem and is so skillfully. I wonder if that's because he's so practiced and seasoned. It doesn't seem that he manipulated those words.
Oh, no. I think it probably just, you know, it's probably just falling out of his voice in a very natural way. Yeah.
Then in this book, you make a very important point that here's form. It's important. It has its place, and here's why we use it. But, hey, write from your heart,
mm-hmm.
and you will find the form. What do you mean by that?
Well, John Berger, who's a writer whose work I admire a lot, he's a British writer, essayist, novelist, art critic. Somewhere he said that form ought to feel as if it were inevitable. And I think that in order for that to happen, I think it has to come very much out of your natural life in a way. You have to, you know, you can't force your personality into a form that doesn't fit you, you know, and that I believe that poems sort of take their own shape as they develop. If a poem begins, you're writing the first few lines and suddenly it rhymes, well, maybe it's worth pursuing that rhyme a little bit and see if you can do it. You know, you might have to back off on it if it doesn't work. Or if it's clear that it wants to be a very loose, free form, you can pursue that and see how well it works and everything. You know, you have to trust your instincts a little bit on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing is to try to fill a box, like take a sonnet form and write all the rhymes down the right-hand side and then try to write lines that fit them. I mean, it's just dreadful.
I did it once.
Oh, yeah. I think we all have tried.
I came out with Sestinas that looked like marble columns. They were just standing there.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Ted Kooser talking to us. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress talking about Poetry Home Repair Manual, which is a book about the love of poetry, but he doesn't come out and say it, but that's what it's about. Now, there is a chapter called Writing About Feelings. Not as easy as it sounds, because you can really mess up if that's all you're going on, writing about feelings. But you do choose some interesting poems there, and one is by you have written yourself. It's called After Years. Interesting, because you state that it is about loss, but you never come out and say.
Mm-hmm.
So let us hear that poem.
Yeah, I might preface it by saying that this is a poem about having seen a woman with whom I was in love at one time, but I hadn't seen her for a long, long time, and I saw her across the street, and I was just struck by this, you know. And so I tried to write the poem in a way that would express my feelings without stating them overtly.
Now, you see why radio is important. You didn't have the in love stuff in that book. That's coming out now.
Yeah.
You just said it was somebody you knew.
Oh, yes.
So let's hear
it. After Years. Today, from a distance, I saw you walking away, and without a sound, the glittering face of a glacier slid into the sea. An ancient oak fell in the Cumberlands, holding only a handful of leaves, and an old woman, scattering corn to her chickens, looked up for an instant. At the other side of the galaxy, a star 35 times the size of our own sun exploded and vanished, leaving a small green spot on the astronomer's retina as he stood in the great open dome of my heart with no one to tell.
Mm. That is your signature. The two things are the moment in time that is like a chip, a crystal chip, that is one thing you work with. And the second thing is no one to tell. That is a haunting refrain in your work,
mm-hmm.
where you... That is almost worse than a death.
Uh-huh.
Because you're about communication.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's the power of that poem. Mm-hmm. That last line is a dynamite last line. I love that. We're talking about craft, form, and love. And they're all going together in this book. I'm Grace Cavalieri. That's Ted Kooser across the table. And in the book, he cites other poets who exemplify things about poetry. And so we're going to move on to Jane Kenyon.
All right.
Who died too soon and left a nice legacy.
Yes, this is one of Jane Kenyon's lovely poems. She was a marvelous poet. In the Nursing Home. She is like a horse grazing a hill pasture that someone makes smaller by coming every night to pull the fences in and in. She has stopped running wide loops, stopped even the tight circles. She drops her head to feed, grass is dust, and the creek bed's dry. Master, come with your light halter, come and bring her in.
What a poem.
Oh, isn't that marvelous?
Yeah. Wow. So glad you put that. Then we move to the country of memory. Memory is a place that doesn't go away. The past doesn't go anywhere at all, does it?
That's right. That's right.
And that's a big chapter, a very important chapter. One thing that interested me is I do help people with their books, and I always like to see a uniformity of presentation, and I happen to note that each of your chapters was about 10 pages. Did you know that?
Oh, I suppose I noticed it at some point. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I thought that that was really important because it speaks to you're having a rhythm yourself. And I think a few chapters were a couple of pages more.
Mm-hmm.
This might have been one of them, writing from memory. What is the country of memory?
Well, I have a poem in my book, The Lights and Shadows, in which I talk about it being sort of like a tornado that sweeps everything up in it. And then at the tip of the tornado is the nib of a pen. You have everything in your memory, and then you just sort of let it out a little at a time, you know. But, the country of memory is a very rich place, you know. It's huge. I'm always so struck when people die, and I'm thinking, all of that is gone with them, you know. All of those memories, you know, that, you know, just, you know, a tremendous volume of memories is going into the grave with those people, you know.
What a thought. I teach that our lives are a building, and each year is a different floor. Mm-hmm. So that I'm a skyscraper, but I mean, if you're 50, you have 50 floors.
Yeah.
And when the end of your life, you stand on the roof and a helicopter sweeps you away and your building crumbles, because in effect, that is what happens. But until then, we can visit every floor of our building every day and find a poem.
Oh, that's right.
Take that elevator.
Yeah.
Get off on floor 3. What do you see?
Yeah.
And that is such a wonderful way to visit your life, because they're here while you're here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I said somewhere in this book that the reason that the human head is so heavy, it's the heaviest, most dense part of the body, is because it is so full of that stuff, you know, like a bank full of nickels.
Your database.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Kooser is talking about his database, which he put in this book. So we will talk about writing from memory. And one of these poems is Amakai.
Mm-hmm.
Is that I walked past a house where once I lived?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us who he is.
Well, he died, I would think, within the last 10 years.
Not long ago.
Yeah.
Yehuda,
was an Israeli. Israeli poet, a marvelous poet, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yehuda Amakai.
Yeah. I walked past a house where I lived once. A man and a woman are still together in the whispers there. Many years have passed with the quiet hum of the staircase bulb going on and off again. The keyholes are like little wounds where all the blood seeped out. And inside, people pale as death. I want to stand once again as I did, holding my first love all night long in the doorway. When we left at dawn, the house began to fall apart, and since then the city, and since then the whole world. I want to be filled with longing again, till dark burn marks show on my skin. I want to be written again in the book of life, to be written every single day, till the writing hand hurts.
Mm. I wonder if you know that when you read a poem out loud, how you favor your vowels.
I guess I don't know that.
I've been listening to every one of them and been wanting to say that and forgetting to. That as I listen to them, you really are unconsciously riding them beautifully.
Hmm.
And so it's interesting. We'll be watching that in the next poems too. Then
I'm probably going to be terribly self-conscious about it now, but we'll try it.
Ted Kooser's going to start stuttering, and it's all my fault. Frank Steele, who is he, the poet you
mentioned?
Frank
Steele has taught for many years at Western Kentucky University in Bowling Green. He and his wife, Peggy, are both poets. They're retired from the university now. I've known Frank's work for many, many years. He's really never gotten the kind of attention he should have had. He's a terrific poet.
You've been communicating with poets your whole life.
I have, yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting, because you hark back to different times in your life where you must communication by postcard, by letter. This has taken up an inordinate amount of your life, more than many.
Well, I don't know. You know, it's been very important to me, and part of it is because, you know, the place where I live, you know, we don't have a lot of poets close around us. We're not down drinking coffee with them in the coffee shop. You know, we're communicating by letter and postcard, as you say, and that's part of it, I think. You know, I have my letters bound every year. I save them, and I've done this for over 30 years now, 33 years now, and I have I save copies of the letters I write and copies. If you wrote me a letter, I would, on a postcard, let's say, I would Xerox it onto a full sheet and bind it into this volume. And so I have all this stuff. It's quite a trove of information. And
I wish I had done that. How important. How many volumes do you have?
Well, most of the years are two volumes, you know, probably that together maybe 7 or 8 inches thick. And I have 33 years of those, so I suppose there are probably 50 volumes altogether.
So your papers are at the University of Nebraska?
Actually, they're at home in my corn crib. but they will eventually be somewhere.
With the snakes that you read
yeah,
about.
Yeah.
Ted Kooser is here. He's brought lots of fresh air from the Plain States into Washington, D.C. In talking about the poem we just heard, Parents, by Frank Steele, then you go into a phrase which you call biting off words,
mm-hmm.
not using too much fat
yeah,
in your poem.
Yeah.
And you think Frank Steele is a good example of a man, yes, who could have put a lot more in.
But the poem is right down to the bare essentials, no spare parts, which is one of my mottos. You know, you don't need to, if you're building a lawnmower, you don't put in extra belts and pulleys. You know, it's going to mow the grass with what it's got. It doesn't need any more than that, you know. So I believe in, you know, making the poem as economic as possible.
And you do talk about the anecdote, which I am very fond of, because that is one thing beginning poets can do, is just listen to the conversation at the next table. But the anecdote really needs something else going on to make it a poem.
Yeah, it can't be just simply an anecdote. You know, I went downtown this morning and this happened and I came home. It has to, in some way, move beyond that a little bit. Take a glimpse into something in the next world, sort of, you know, that
right,
kind of thing. Or touch against something that has a little electricity to it. And we see so many poems that are just anecdote, simply just spaced out and written down the page, you know. Every time I stand at the kitchen peeling cucumbers, I think of my grandmother who used to stand at the kitchen peeling cucumbers.
Actually, know? I like that.
But you can have it then. Yeah.
It is putting a perspective, maybe a little philosophical. Maybe even the title could do it.
Mm-hmm.
But just raising it off the ground a little bit.
It needs, the Chinese poets say, you need to lift your eyes from the poem. When you're writing.
I love that. Lifting your eyes. And that is, an anecdote is described in that, I think, that chapter writing from memory. But we're going to move on because we have a few more of my favorite things I want to address. You have a chapter called Working with Detail. And that is basically just about, specifics,
mm-hmm.
and noticing things.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll hear something from each one of those areas.
Okay.
You talk about a poem which is entitled Neighbors.
Oh, yes. Dave Evans' poem. Dave is the poet laureate of South Dakota.
Is he, what press does he have? I think he's the editor for...
No, I don't think so.
Not Dave?
No. Dave is David Allen Evans.
I'm thinking of Dave Smith.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll move on.
Yeah, Dave Smith does that Southern Messenger series for LSU, yeah. Anyway, Dave Evans, this is his poem. This is an older poem of his. It goes back a number of years, but I just love it. Neighbors. They live alone together, she with her wide hind and bird face. He with his hung belly and crew cut. They never talk but keep busy. Today they are washing windows, each window together. She on the inside, he on the outside. He squirts Windex at her face. She squirts Windex at his face. Now they are waving to each other with rags, not smiling.
That was featured in one of your newspaper columns.
Yeah, the first one. Yes, that's right.
Tells so much.
Oh, yeah. It's marvelous. Yeah.
And the specifics there are so close to the bone. But yeah. We know these people.
We know them. And, you know, one of the things I like about the poem is that it is written in great good humor. You know, it really, it's not being judgmental about these people at all, you know.
Really, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Because many poems can become jeering.
Oh, yeah.
When we think it's high style.
Yeah, not good.
No goodwill is like what it's about.
Yeah.
And in that line, we will talk about Ted Kooser at the cosmetics department. We don't know what you were doing walking through that department store, but you just happened to notice something.
Yes, you know, my father for many years was a department store manager, and so I've spent a lot of time in department stores over the years. And this was in the walking through the cosmetics department in a store in Lincoln, Nebraska. Cosmetics department. A fragrance heavy as dust, and two young women motionless as mannequins dressed in black. The white moth of timelessness flutters about them, unable to leave the cool light of their faces. One holds the other's head in her hands like a mirror. The other leans into the long fingers, knowing how heavy her beauty is. Eye to eye, breath into breath, they lean as if frozen forever. A white cup with two lithe figures painted in black and the warm wine brimming.
So much going on.
Mm-hmm. I was so struck, very typical of me, the way I start a poem. I was struck by seeing those women holding each other's heads and gazing into each other's faces, you know. It's such a marvelous thing, you know.
And you made it permanent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Noticing things. I guess that would be the first thing on the poet's job resume.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Keep your eyes open. Nothing is unimportant.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-mm. And you're proving that for us. Then we get into the sticky stuff of adverbs, adjectives, nouns, and verbs, which are our stock and trade. And the chapter is called Controlling Effects Through Careful Choices. And it seems that adjectives have a bad rap.
Yeah, they do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you are a little nicer about it.
Well, the way it works is you need modifiers. If you put a chicken into a poem and just say a chicken crossed the road, then everybody who's reading the poem has their own idea of what the chicken is like. Could be a white one, could be a red one, could be fat or thin, half the feathers gone or plump. It takes one adjective to do that. Just say plump chicken makes a whole difference in the way the image is. And I'm very interested in communicating the precise image to the reader.
Yes.
I want them to see the chicken that I'm seeing. So you have to use modifiers. And it's just that too many adjectives, I mean, become obvious, you know. That's the problem, yeah.
But then you go on to say, choose the right word.
Well, that's right, yeah. Yeah, it's very important to spend a lot of time making those choices, I think.
Right. Yeah. And a good poem that exemplifies that is Sheep by Robert Francis. Who's Robert Francis?
Robert Francis has been dead for many years. He was a New England poet, lived his last years in Amherst, a really marvelous poet. I think that he was overshadowed by Robert Frost. You know, they had the same initials. They were living at the same time. But Francis's poems are well worth looking at. He's a really marvelous poet, a solitary man. I'm doing what I can to remind people that he's out there. You know?
Well, yeah. I've met a lot of new friends in this book.
Yeah. Anyway, here's Francis's poem, Sheep. From where I stand, the sheep stand still as stones against the stony hill. The stones are gray, and so are they. And both are weather-worn and round, leading the eye back to the ground. Two mingled flocks, the sheep, the rocks, and still no sheep stirs from its place or lifts its Babylonian face. It's just such a touch, isn't
what
it, that word?
What a lovely... And you make that point. The word Babylonian...
is the important word. Mm-hmm.
It makes all the difference.
It hauls in all sorts of stuff into that scene.
That historical, yeah. it resonates
yeah.
with
yeah.
imagery.
Yeah, and we know right away, we you know, anyone who's looked, studied, you know, art knows what a Babylonian sheep's face would look like, you know. I mean, it's right there. It's just, his work is so wonderful, you know. He has a poem about watching three men walk down the road in the morning and come back at night. That's all it is, you know, but it's just loaded with feeling, you know.
The right word,
yeah.
choosing the
yeah.
right word. And then the next biggie in life is metaphor and simile. And when you go into the classroom, that's the only thing that the fifth grade teacher has taught the kids. So, you know, this is a metaphor and this is a simile, and then you have to take off from that
yeah.
and
yeah.
light their fire. What is a metaphor and what is a simile?
Well, you know, a metaphor is a comparison that is more like an identity. You say, that bunch of grapes is a stack of cannonballs, rather than saying that bunch of grapes is like a stack of cannonballs, which is a simile. I think there's a difference in the psychology. Mm. The first has an emphasis and an authority. The grapes are the cannonballs. The second is much more human in ways. We say so often in a description, we'd say, that bunch of grapes, it's kind of like a pile of cannonballs, you know. It feels more like conversation, I think the simile does. So you have to kind of measure how much authority you want in the poem as to whether or not you use the metaphors. Of course, there are poems that will work in other ways as well, but that's just one of the things to think about, I think.
Well, what I liked is that you took us along on your own struggle with a poem that could have had a metaphor or could have started with a simile, and it's called The Possible Lives.
Yeah.
And that will explain a lot, if you'll read that one.
The Possible Lives. There were once so many I might choose among, a warehouse of coats and shoes and all my size. Walking the streets, I imagined myself in every house, happy with whichever woman might be living there. How might it be to be at home among the odors of 100 different lives, opening the curtains each morning to a different view? Now I know that this life I have is the only one I have ever had or will ever be given, a cord of braided dreams that I follow hand over hand into the distance.
And you say that you had a choice in the beginning.
Yeah, you know, I might have said, there were once so many I might choose among, like a warehouse of coats and shoes and all my size. And, you know, I decided to go with the metaphor, basically for the strength of the metaphor rather than the simile.
So read that line again. That is a metaphor.
The metaphor is, there were once so many I might choose among, a warehouse of coats and shoes and all my size.
Instead of like a warehouse.
Yeah.
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 That's
yeah.
a very good example,
yeah.
I think, in that. Then a metaphor-centered poem is where you take a comparison and just ride it. I think Diane Wachowski does that very well.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the extended metaphor in her poems, for example, My Grandfather's Watch, where she can just reel that thing in stanza after stanza. And you have a couple that are good examples. One is The Student, which starts with a simple comparison, you say. And that's...
you remember where that
numbers,
one is?
It's 16 on a stickum.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, my stickums kind of got lost there.
Student. The green shell of his backpack makes him lean into wave after wave of responsibility, and he swings his stiff arms and cupped hands paddling ahead. He has extended his neck to its full length, and his chin, hard as a beak, breaks the cold surf. He's got his baseball cap on backward, as up he crawls, out of the froth of a hangover, and onto the sand of the future, and lumbers, heavy with hope, into the library.
That's in your book, Delights and Shadows.
Yes, that's right.
And that was just by watching a turtle of a student.
Well, yeah, I'd noticed that in the 60s when people walked with very long straight hair, they kind of swung their head from side to side, and that was sort of the sign of that particular period. And now people, when they're wearing backpacks, sort of paddle with their arms when they're walking along, I noticed, particularly if the backpack is full. And I just couldn't resist this image, you know.
And you did that in another way with your poem, The Camera, which is a simple comparison.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be another good one to read.
Camera.
That's there.
Camera. It's an old box camera, a brownie, the color and shape of the battery out of a car, but smaller, lighter. All the good times, the clumsy picnics on the grass, the new Dodge, the Easter Sundays, each with its own clear instant in the fluid of time. All these have leaked away, leaving this shell, this little battery, without a spark.
Beautiful. That spark does it.
Mm-hmm.
Both the battery and the camera are...
holds it all together.
But it's all gone.
Yeah.
Except
mm-hmm.
for these relics.
Yeah.
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 And now that we have just gotten to know you, sadly we have to have a closing poem.
Okay.
And that will be one of my very favorites of yours. It's called A Rainy Morning. And it's right here.
A Rainy Morning. A young woman in a wheelchair, wearing a black nylon poncho spattered with rain, is pushing herself through the morning. You have seen how pianists sometimes bend forward to strike the keys, then lift their hands, draw back to rest, then lean again to strike just as the chord fades. Such is the way this woman strikes at the wheels, then lifts her long white fingers, letting them float, then bends again to strike just as the chair slows, as if into a silence. So expertly she plays the chords of this difficult music she has mastered, her wet face beautiful in its concentration, while the wind turns the pages of rain.
The voice of Ted Kooser, Poet Laureate of the United States, Pulitzer Prize winner for poetry. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. The Witter-Binner series is brought to you by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C. and the Witter-Binner Foundation for Poetry. You can hear this series on www.loc.gov/poetry. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Additional funding was provided by the National Endowment for the Arts because a great nation deserves great art. Our engineer is Bill Haley. I'm Grace Cavalieri.